WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello and welcome to WrestleSpective. I am your host, Jason Mann. Joining me again is multi-time guest Will Pruitt of ProWrestling.net. Will, welcome back to the show, sir.
I'm glad there's a show again to come back to. I'm psyched about that. I missed your podcast. I legitimately was excited when I saw another episode get added.
Well, I'm happy to hear that, and it's good to be back. It was a needed hiatus, but I am certainly glad to be back in the swing of things, enjoying some old and some new wrestling, particularly with the WWE Network providing many enjoyable moments, revisiting old memories and gaining new ones, seeing shows that I've heard about for years but never seen. So it's a it's a lot of good times.
Yeah, the network has definitely been an exciting dose of a wrestling goodness added in. It's just so much easier to access the old pay-per-views now, where before if you wanted to seek something out, you'd check your daily motions, your YouTube, your torrent sites, and now, hey, it's all right there. And you actually have the opportunity to pay for it, because in the past, there was no way to pay for all of in your house, beware of dog. You just couldn't do it.
Right, exactly. And that's certainly something that all of us have been desperately wanting to pay for a long time. We want to see how beware of dog ends. We want to see why. We know that we should beware of the dog, but we want to know why we should beware of that dog.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I still don't understand.
All right, well, that'll be another show, because this show, we're going to discuss a show that you cannot find on WWE Network. It is the November 19th, 2011, excuse me, 2001 Raw, coming after the Survivor Series 2001, which was the end of the WWF versus Alliance storyline, in which the much reduced forces of WCW and ECW came forth together to mount a challenge to WWF sovereignty, but alas, WWF was able to fend them off at the Survivor Series, winner take all 5-on-5 match, in which the main points for the purpose of this show is that Kurt Angle, who had recently defected from WWF to the Alliance, turns out he was playing both sides, and he enabled the Team WWF to gain the win by attacking Steve Austin at the end. I believe he hit him with a chair, or maybe with the belt, and I saw it a week ago and I can't even remember the ending of it now. And then The Rock was able to pick up the win for his team after he had been attacked by his teammate Chris Jericho.
Yeah, I think that's the only thing. I mean, there was the sad Mick Foley eats food in WWF New York segment on that show, and other things like the Immunity Battle Royal and stuff that kind of play into this episode. But the main point, at least with the main eventers on this show, is the Kurt Angle moment.
Yeah, that's the focus of the show. Those are the two. And the Chris Jericho thing is brought up a decent amount as well.
Yeah.
Really, this show is about, I mean, it's kind of about a lot of things. It's really about hitting the reset button and completely putting the Alliance in the past and completely foraging a new way, and shuffling the pieces to have Kurt Angle and Chris Jericho as your two lead bad guys, Steve Austin and The Rock, but particularly Steve Austin, placed again firmly on the good guy side. But
Yeah, and
we have to
it's
move a lot of
interesting.
pieces to get there. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yes. I found it really interesting when you watch the show. You get the sense that WWF at the time was trying to get back to what worked. Like, they had turned Austin heel and WCW was gone, and the invasion to a lot of people was this creative failure, and it turned a lot of fans off. And I feel like this show, so many parts of it were like, all right, you know what? This worked a few years ago. You had a Vince McMahon turning kind of back into the lead heel in the promotion on this show after being the big baby face, sympathetic owner of the WWF. My small business is going to be conquered by my own children guy. You had him turning back into evil Mr. McMahon. You had Steve Austin turning into this baby face. And it's like they went, okay, scratch it all. We need to go with what got us here in the first place. And it was an attempt almost all in one episode of Raw to do that.
Yeah, definitely. They're covering a lot of ground here. So, to begin, we have Mick Foley, who is at the WWF commissioner, who is on the corporate jet with Vince McMahon. Vince is enjoying a shrimp cocktail, and he'll need the energy because he's on this show quite a bit. Mick Foley wants Vince to fire him. This is kind of, I guess, playing off of feelings that Foley has in real life about his diminished role in WWF and not really being involved in storylines that much, and sort of being peripherally the commissioner of the WWF, although he's like the fifth or sixth most important authority figure in when it comes to all of the various ECW, WCW, and WWF authority figures. But he, so it's playing off of those real life feelings. He would actually be gone for almost 2 years after this, but he wants Vince to fire him, but Vince instead tells him to have a nice day. And that's it. And then we go to the Raw introduction and Vince McMahon coming out again.
Yeah, I thought the Foley thing was interesting. If you're watching this and you haven't, obviously I didn't watch the Raw before this, or a month before, just watch the pay-per-view and then this. I watched the Foley thing and was like, oh, well, that's interesting. It's not really consequential to the overall show. I almost think with what the end goal of this show was to do with Vince McMahon, he probably could have done a little more to Mick Foley to get him to leave.
Yeah, right. I guess it really wasn't that wouldn't have been appropriate at this stage in the show when Vince is still the ostensibly the good guy. Like that would have maybe come later in the show, but yes, definitely with the goal they're trying to accomplish, they could have done a lot more to try to humiliate Foley. And I don't know if that was more of just they wanted to send, if there were kind of some ill feelings, they would just want to send off Mick in a nice way, or if Mick didn't want to do it, or if they just didn't have feel like they had time to fit that in, or it could be kind of any of those things.
Yeah, it could really be anything there. And it was probably they just didn't want to embarrass Mick Foley on the way out. Unlike now, how they try to embarrass Mick Foley on the way everywhere.
Mick's been a long time from that Hell in a Cell fall. So every year he
Yeah.
gets away from it, he's less famous, I guess. So, although with WWE Network, everyone's gonna be able to watch it again.
And again, because we all haven't seen it enough. I mean, I don't know exactly the angle that Foley's body was at when he went through that table.
Right, that's true. You have to analyze that film.
Yeah.
So as I mentioned, Vince comes out to start the show. He gloats and soaks in the cheers of the fans. He says tonight is a night for celebration, and that we owe one man a debt of gratitude that perhaps we may never be able to repay, referring to Kurt Angle. And because of Kurt Angle, WCW and ECW are now dead. He addresses the fact that the only remnant left is the belt around Rock's waist, which he says will be referred to now as the world title. He does not mention the Cruiserweight title surviving the which of course is a surprise considering the importance that Vince McMahon has always placed on Cruiserweight wrestling.
Yeah, he really cares about those cruiserweights. So I too was surprised about that.
Yep.
It seems like maybe the Cruiserweight title just slipped his mind. Of course, he would go on to emphasize it so extremely well over the next 11, 12 years.
Yeah. So Vince promises drastic changes. He says that there will be the first member of the Kiss My Ass Club that had just started that morning. He promises to execute his plans when Stone Cold enters the building, which sounds ominous. Vince also mocks the fans by doing the what chant at them. He addresses the empty chair next to Jim Ross, says that he would like to invite Paul Heyman to come out. Heyman is wearing a duster jacket and suit combo with a WWF Attitude hat, which I don't know if that was in style in 2001, but it's certainly far less out of style in 2014.
Yeah, I don't think it was ever in style. That was just Heyman's look at the time. He hadn't quite discovered evil suit-wearing Paul Heyman yet.
That's true. That's a better look for him.
Yeah, it definitely is. Worse was when Heyman came back in the jacket and all of that combo at the one-night stand shows. That was a little embarrassing.
Yeah, well, nobody's perfect. Heyman is good at other things, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, he's all right. He's a good talker. He does some talking here, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
He approaches Jim Ross, saying, "I got away with it," and goes to sit next to him. But instead, Vince calls Heyman up, says that he appreciates people who speak their mind, and then he says, "You're fired," pretty much right after that. The reaction is great to all of it. Heyman's look of shock, Vince pointing to the door, Heyman then taking off his jacket, challenging Vince. Vince then taking off his jacket, and Heyman cowardly running away, but then going after Jim Ross. Jim Ross getting a few punches in, screaming, "Come on, you son of a bitch." Then security drags Heyman away, and right as Heyman is coming out, Vince introduces his replacement, Jerry the King Lawler. They pass each other with Lawler pointing and laughing at Heyman. And Jim Ross says that all is right with the world, at least at the announce table. Lawler comes in and sort of actually more presents himself as a heel, kind of saying, "Hey, it's over between me and you," to Jim Ross. And I don't know if he really acts that way at all during the rest of the show. He's pretty much the old, you know, horny old man, Jerry Lawler, who, you know, he does like Kurt Angle a lot. But other than that, I don't feel like it's that different of a level of Jerry Lawler. But I don't know. Did you particularly notice any differences from Jerry Lawler's of previous incarnations?
He kind of seemed to be favoring the heels more, which I think he got out of. You know, he still did it occasionally, but he got out of towards the end of his run before in the WWF. And now he's back to favoring heels a little bit more, but it's still I mean, you just don't have the conflict between Lawler and Ross like you did between Ross and Heyman. There wasn't just that you know, the part of what Jerry Lawler and Jim Ross did so well was their chemistry, and you just didn't have that natural conflict the way that Heyman and Ross did, which, you know, Heyman and Ross's conflict was a little much.
Yeah, I mean, they were good together, but yeah, that conflict, I think, made the show, like, it obviously furthered
stressful.
The story they were telling, but it made the show less enjoyable to watch sometimes.
Yeah, and Ross, what do you think of those punches he threw? I thought he enjoyed that.
They look good. I don't know. I always kind of get... I've always been a little confused about the real feelings between Jim Ross and Paul Heyman. Like, at certain points, it seems like they have not liked each other. But I think Ross has always sort of indicated that he and Heyman don't really have any issues. So I don't always really know what to make of that.
Yeah, they're chill now, obviously. Like, they're homies at this point.
Sure. I'm sure they refer to themselves as homies as well. I'm sure they hang out at their crib, you know, and...
And listen to Roland with the homies.
I would imagine so. I can see that. I'm imagining
yeah,
that right
too.
Now. And
it seems like a great thing for Jim Ross to do.
Yeah. Well, he's in semi-retirement. I mean, might as well hang out with your homies. Roll with them, as a matter of fact.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So anything else of note during the segment that you would like to mention?
You know, just because it comes into play so much later, Vince McMahon really pouring on the praise for Kurt Angle. And from the very beginning, Jim Ross not really being behind it, I thought was interesting. Again, with them trying to do so much, obviously Ross, who also worked in the office at the time, was in on what they were trying to do. He knew what the goals of the show were and knew the format, all of that. So you have Ross starting to tell the viewers at home, Kurt Angle's not a hero from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's been not really much. There's no reason that the fans would really think that before Jim Ross telling you, which is,
yeah.
And I guess maybe if you're kind of seeing Vince as a little bit of a villain and the overpraise there, but yeah, they're definitely working to get you in that direction from the beginning.
Oh yeah.
So we have Lita with Matt Hardy against Trish Stratus for the women's title. Trish had won it the night before in a six way, if I recall correctly.
Yeah,
and it was vacant, right? So
yeah, it was before that. So Trish just won it.
Yeah, it was her sixth championship, or I'm sorry, her first championship. I believe she won six of them overall. Maybe that's a number that sticks out to me, but I could be completely off because it's not the type of thing that it's the type of thing I would have remembered when I was 12, but not so much today.
Yeah. This was a bad match. Like it looked really clumsy. Like I watching Trish in the six way, I thought that she looked good, not as good as Trish Stratus would go on to look,
sure,
in the ring. But I thought she looked good. And then watching this match that was a night later, I was like, ooh, they were able to hide a lot in that six-way because Trish looks really, really bad here. And Lita didn't look much better.
Yeah, there's a bunch of clunky, there's a weird like arm bar takedown by Lita where Trish just sort of falls down, just sort of some awkward standing around and tripping over things. The end was pretty good. Lita, she takes a pretty big bump, being pushed off top of the barricade. Then Matt hugs Lita, and Trish drop kicks her into him. He's very angry about this at Trish, and then he thoughtlessly picks up Lita and puts her in the ring to avoid 10, but it's too quick, and she's dazed. And then Trish wins with a backslide.
It was a cute way to tell the story of, you know, Matt putting Lita in harm's way, but I don't know that it was the most effective way either. They're kind of trying to tell a story, I think, that ended up leading to Matt Hardy versus Jeff Hardy at that Vengeance pay-per-view in San Diego in 2001.
Yeah.
But so they're kind of starting to tell that story here, and I don't feel like it was extremely effective.
I mean, I thought it was well enough told. I guess, you know, you're kind of, this is more obviously the tension between Matt and Lita, and they had told that a little bit the night before with Trish coming out of Matt's locker room, or after out of the locker room after Matt had been in there. So, but that Hardy story really didn't end up going anywhere, and they all ended up being back together at the Royal Rumble anyway. So we don't need to talk about it anymore is what I'm saying.
We don't. And then they got drafted to separate brands, and Jeff Hardy had a ladder match with The Undertaker and drugs.
Yes. And Matt Hardy became Matt Hardy version one and probably was the most fun version of himself his entire career.
Well, I would like to think that version one of myself is the most fun version of me as well.
That's fair. I'm not going to argue.
Yeah, I mean, the beta testing was kind of hit or miss, had some bonus features here and there, but I definitely think version 1 put my best foot forward there.
I think 3.2 has been the best version of me.
You've gone through a lot of changes.
I have evolved quite a bit.
I can't wait for Jason XP.
Yeah, it's going to be huge.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome.
Yes. So Vince McMahon is in the locker room, which includes the last remnants of the Alliance, the Dudleys, Stacy Keibler, Christian, Test, and Rob Van Dam. He initially pretends he has no grudge, but then decides to put Rob Van Dam, who had earlier refused an offer to join WWF, in a tables match against the Dudleys. The match is next, so I'm glad they were all dressed to wrestle. And then Vince blows off Christian when he says that he's proud to be European champion and offers his hand in friendship. So we go to the Rob Van Dam Dudley's tables match. And there's an amusing Lawler JR encounter where Lawler asks where Stacy is from. Ross at first doesn't know and then remembers or is reminded that she's in fact from Baltimore, which is because she was a Baltimore Ravens cheerleader, I believe. And I'm th this is one thing Lawler kind of does throughout the show where he is sort of like, oh, you know, I've been gone for 9 months. What's been going on with things? You know, now, and I don't know. I'm sure it's probably a combination, and even more so of Lawler just, you know, maybe not actually being up on things because he's kind of sort of notorious for not watching wrestling beyond the shows that he comments on. But I just wonder how much he's playing that up, or and how much he genuinely doesn't know it. Obviously, we have no idea, but I think that's sort of interesting.
I want to guess and say he doesn't know.
Yeah.
Just I think Lawler. I was reading a little bit about how Lawler came back in preparation for this, and it seems like it wasn't like he knew a month out he was coming back, so he should be turning on Raw and watching. It was like a week or two out. Hey, so want to do this again? And he said yes.
Yeah,
So that.
he did commentary for the Curt Hennig Hulk Hogan XWF match, which I believe occurred 5 days before this. So that was so certainly, yeah, he would not have been there would not have been a whole lot of lead time.
None. Like, kind of a strange, you know, I get bringing him back again, especially when you think about the theme of going with what works, with what works before. Like, all right, well, Paul Heyman was grating. That drove people away. People loved Jerry Lawler. Let's have him say puppies again.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I do think he did good things for the show. I mean, Lawler's pretty not popular as a commentator these days, and I get why, and I agree that he certainly has his negative points, but he had his positive points too. He had good energy, you know. He did have a connect, you know. He's always had a connection with crowds, obviously, and as an announcer, he had a connection with people, and he had. Ross had the chemistry, so I get bringing him in. I think they've probably held on to him too long for at least being the lead announcer of Raw, but you know they get in the habit of things and just kind of stick with it. Yeah, I mean it was popular decision to bring him back because people liked him, so I guess it doesn't make sense, but it does definitely fit into that theme you're talking about. So the Dudleys pretend to shake hands with RVD, but double team him instead. They are pretty anxious to beat him up, in fact. They don't really seem to have any qualms about fighting Rob Van Dam.
Well, and who would?
Well, they are Alliance team members. I mean, you know.
It's true. Well, was this the first real heel turn we got on the show?
No,
Because I would.
the Dudleys had been heels the entire time during the
Oh,
Alliance
yeah.
story.
But they weren't. I won't say the first real heel turn. The first example of like heels at least trying to turn a baby face. Because this I and Rob Van Dam was a baby face in general, but there was always that conflict of him being an Alliance member, but doing so many crowd pleasing things and fans really wanting to see him and being a legitimate attraction. I think there's something turn-esque to this.
Yeah, I guess I think of more, I guess, a cementing than turning, but I see what you mean. Ross is already calling the Dudleys arguably the best of all time, which, you know, might be a little bit. I mean, they were together for a lot longer, so I kind of get it, you know, after having been together for like 15, 20 years or so, but they've been together like 5 years before this, so that might have been jumping the gun a little bit. we do get a pretty nasty finish
Yeah.
where Devon is on top of one table. Van Damme flies basically three-fourths across the ring doing a frog splash and then crashes through the table very hard.
And Devon moved.
Well, yeah, Devon moved. So yes, he went through the table, not through Devon and the table. And
Head first.
head first, yeah, he looked pretty dazed. And then the Dudleys quickly try to do a 3D attempt onto another table, but unfortunately, it does not break, so they are forced to do a 3D on a second the second time, and it does break. So I feel bad for Rob Van Dam there.
Yeah, that was a crazy bump he took, or not even a bump. That was just a crazy fall through that first table that looked just a little too far away. It was just probably about 2 feet out of Rob Van Dam's range, or maybe even Rob Van Dam makes that if Devon's on the ground, but the table being elevated, Van Dam can't get as far and stay as high. Really, really rough bump there. And then, of course, the first 3D not working was you could almost tell Bubba Ray and Devon are just like, oh man, all right, gotta do another. Like, we're sorry, Rob.
I would not have felt good at that situation, but
Yeah.
they got through it, and Rob Van Dam seems okay today, so
Yeah, he's doing just fine.
probably smoking his pot, having a good old time.
Well, that's how he got through this.
That's
This
true.
whole time, really. I think that's probably how he solves every problem, but I'm definitely going to say it's how he got through this injury.
I'll go ahead and say that you're right there. So Kurt Angle comes into the building. He's late, but I guess it's okay. He did save the day last night. A guy with the headset asks how he's doing. Kurt says, "How you think I'm doing?" He's brags about being awesome and says, "Hey, I want to find the Rock." So we go find the Rock. We also, before we get do that though, we do see Linda McMahon saying hi to the people in WWF New York.
How disappointing is that? You go to WWF New York for Raw. You know they always have a star there. Like, you're thinking, like, worst case scenario, what, Tajiri? Like, how bad can this be? Worst case scenario, I get maybe X-Pac at that point.
Sean
Someone who doesn't
Stasiak,
really matter. Yeah. And Linda McMahon walks up, and you're like, I didn't even think that I would get this.
did not even occur to me.
And she's just shaking hands at tables. Like, was she starting her Senate campaign already? She's just like, by the way, Linda 2012.
Hey, it's never too early to start.
It's true. I mean, I respect her if she was starting it that
I
early,
mean,
but
granted, she's in New York and not Connecticut, but it's close enough, I suppose.
those people
She'll run into a
established.
few Connecticutans. I
Yeah.
don't know what a person from Connecticut is called.
Connecticut's?
A Connecticutian. A Connecticutian. I don't know. I never thought about that.
I don't think we need to think about it anymore.
Well, I'm going to be thinking about the rest of the show. I don't know about you, but. So, Kurt Angle comes up to the Rock. And this is the key moment in which we are very, very clearly establishing Kurt Angle is I am the villain in this situation. Basically, Angle wants thanks, but Rock says he's not impressed, says he didn't need any help. He's also pretty mad that Kurt Angle didn't let him in on the plan, especially after he was nailed in the head with chair shots. He makes fun of Kurt for saying, "Well, Mr. McMahon said to keep it quiet." He said that he Rock calls it a selfish big moment, mad about Angle lying to have that. And then at the end, he says, "You might have a lot of people fooled, but the Rock will never trust Vince McMahon or Kurt Angle," and he calls him an asshole.
That's also where we got some more hints that we're not supposed to like Vince McMahon either.
That all good point. Yes, that is true as well. Although Rock doesn't really have any reason to hate Vince. I mean, I guess other than like all the other reasons, like I guess maybe
Yeah.
like turning on him
All
at two WrestleManias in a row, maybe that
Yeah, I would probably have some grudges going back to WrestleMania 2000 and then again at WrestleMania 2001.
I
just
guess
be
that's
like, dude, Vince, the hell, man?
Yeah.
Yeah, not cool.
Yeah.
They really should have talked that over. Like, I would have loved that backstage segment probably more than I would have loved the "We need the old Stone Cold back" speech when they formed the invasion team back at the beginning of 2001. I would have loved just, "Hey Rock, listen, I know I've hit you with a lot of chairs at a lot of WrestleManias,
yes,
but this is bigger than that. I need you."
Sorry about that, dude.
Yeah. Maybe I won't do it next year. Who knows?
It's a nice world title you got there.
Yeah.
I'll let you keep it after we win.
Remember that WrestleMania where I liked you a couple years ago? Yeah.
Yeah. You didn't win that one either, but oh well. So that now we have Steph and Shane driving themselves to the arena, wondering if Steph wonders, do you think he's going to give us our jobs back? And Vince calls them out with no music or fanfare. They come out arm in arm. And
I was sad about the lack of Shane McMahon music.
I know you. That would make you very sad. Shane, however, was wearing the same shirt that he wore when he triumphantly walked on the Panama City Nitro stage.
Yeah, that was nice. I just watched that Nitro, actually.
Yeah.
On the WWE Network.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good one.
Yeah. It's a big moment, you know?
Some fun parallels to this show, actually.
Right.
Some stuff.
Yeah. So obviously the idea is that Shane and Steph are now broke after they invested all their money into WCW and ECW. As Shane and Steph enter the ring, Vince utters the immortal line of, "I can't tell you how proud I am as a father to hear a jam-packed arena shout the chant of slut to my daughter." And then he screams, "What has happened to us?" Which I feel like Vince says that like three or four times during the show. Not like, I think mostly about the family, but also I think about like the WWF.
I think he was legitimately wondering. Like, so many weird things happened during this time. And again, you go back to them kind of being on top of the world around WrestleMania 17. And everyone, you know, that's regarded as a top five pay-per-view ever, if not the best ever. It's always in that conversation. And you go from that to where they were just a few months later with storytelling, with business, if you want to judge things by that. And you can kind of understand why Vince might look around backstage at shows and be like, "Guys, what's happened to us?"
Yeah. So he gives Shane and Steph an opportunity to speak their minds. Shane decides to take the high road, congratulates Vince, says the better man won, and he walks away. Steph, however, takes another approach with quivering voice, says, "Daddy, I made some really, really bad mistakes. I'm young and naive," and then blames everything on Shane. And she goes through all the bad things she did, including slapping Linda, saying that she wanted Vince to die, and says that none of those were her idea. They were all Shane's idea, and that just that she is so sorry, Daddy. Vince teases for a moment and then tell security to get this woman out of my ring, which is great. There's a great line. And she grabs Vince's legs and they all drag her out of the arena to the applause of everyone. So that was fun.
Yeah, I thought that was really fun. Stephanie did a good job there.
Yeah.
She was, you know, she had been kind of obnoxious as, you know, the owner of ECW. And my God, the image of Stephanie McMahon wearing an ECW hat on TV is probably still one of my favorite things.
Yeah.
Just because of the absurdity of it.
Sure.
But she had been grating for a long time. And this was her not being that, thankful, or being that, but for effect. And because she was being written out, she was able to do a little bit more. I like the moment. I like that they let Shane, they didn't have Shane do the same thing, that it was, you know, Shane kind of saying, "Hey, you beat me, that's cool." And then Stephanie being the one to go over the top with it.
Sure, sure. So we have what in what may have there are a lot of Vince segments tonight. So we have Vince backstage on the phone, teases the kiss my ass thing, and then Jericho approaches him. Vince wants him to explain attacking Rock at the Survivor Series, but Jericho doesn't really have a reasonable one. He just sort of says that his ego got in the way, and sort of has a fakey apology. Vince then says he likes a massive ego, but not a big one, and then announces Jericho versus Kane. Now, obviously, I get the motivation why Vince would be mad at Jericho for this, but there wasn't really any clear reason for Jericho to attack Rock anyway, because it's not like Rock really was involved in Jericho being eliminated. He obviously didn't like the Rock, but there wasn't like. You could, if there had been something that Rock had done to trigger Jericho losing, and then Jericho blamed Rock for it, you could get that. That would make a lot more sense. But this is just sort of like they set up Jericho to attack Rock because they wanted to set up the everything they wanted to set up after that. You know, there was no clear motivation for that. And obviously, Vince is putting Jericho in a punishing him by having him wrestle Kane, but Vince and Jericho, as we know, are going to be buddies in a couple of weeks anyway, so it kind of seems silly to have this happen when it doesn't come from anything and doesn't really go anywhere.
Yeah, it's not like Vince would spend the next 6 months making Jericho's life a living hell. He'd spend the, just a month later, he would help him win the Undisputed title. So, yeah, it's weird. It's a little anachronistic. I don't know if they knew at this time, hey, Jericho's going to be Undisputed Champion in 4 weeks. But I mean, I would hope they did, but I really don't think they did. So I would say they just had a rapid change of direction sometime between here and Vengeance.
Yeah, and I guess I mean it does fit in with the Vince domination of the show, but I just thought it was kind of one too many Vince things where they could have approached it in a different way and gotten the same result, basically. So, Mr. T is at ringside with a 1-800 Collect shirt. I had kind of completely forgotten about 1-800 Collect and Mr. T being a thing around this time.
Yeah, I forgot about them being friends. I have to say that Mr. T, apparently they can't bring the two sides together to get Mr. T into the WWE Hall of Fame, but Mr. T has no issues just wearing a random 1-800 Collect shirt to a WWF show. So I don't know what's going on with T and Vince and all of that, but it's strange that he's so willing to wear that 1-800 Collect shirt, but not willing to go into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Side note, they also didn't even mention the WrestleMania 1 main event when they showed Mr. T.
I guess they didn't have Hulk Hogan under the fold at the time, so there's no point in that.
I would have just said one of the main eventers from the original WrestleMania,
Yeah.
Mr.
They
T.
could have mentioned his boxing match with Piper at WrestleMania too.
Yeah, that's true if they want to mention terrible things.
Well, they have no problem mentioning terrible things sometimes, you know. That's never been an obstacle before.
Maybe they were just feeling extra, good.
So now we have the match for the world title between The Rock and Kurt Angle. Ross refers to Angle now as the mole that infiltrated the alliance, which makes him, even though he was working for WWE, still seem kind of shifty. Nobody likes a mole. Nobody likes a rat, you know. Lawler gets the line of that he did some of his best work undercover. I can't remember if this is my note or if this is Ross's note of saying, "Yeah, it got you in trouble sometimes." It feels like something
I
Ross
think
might
that was
say.
Ross.
Okay. Yeah, that makes more sense than me because I'm not usually that funny. So,
That's that dry Oklahoma wit.
yeah, he's good at
All
it.
you have is Ohioan-ness. I don't know.
That
Charm,
was
maybe?
good. That was
Are you
good.
charm? I
Yeah,
know,
that
right?
was some of that.
That's
That was some of that California smoothness right there.
it was. I'm really proud of starting a joke I had no intention of finishing.
All right. Well, good work. So this is a pretty good, although quick match. Everything, including post-match, goes about 10 minutes. Although it does make Jerry Lawler sad to see these two fight because he's such a big fan of Kurt, but he's also a big fan of The Rock. So again, sort of not really exactly a heel, but not exactly a face either. Which, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just sort of interesting the way he kind of tries to be positioned at some points, and at other points, it's just, I guess he's just Jerry Lawler. So I don't need to think about it any more than that. Angle gets some triple Germans on Rock into the match. He goes to the top for a moonsault, but then Rock crotches him and hits a back superplex. After a dueling count, there's a big clothesline by Angle, but the Rock rallies. He hits a throw and a DDT for two. Rock catches Angle with the spine buster and positions him for the rock bottom. Angle avoids it, however, lands the angle slam. He undoes his straps and grabs the ankle. However, Rock is able to roll through and get the three for a pin. Did you enjoy the match?
I did enjoy it. It was the most enjoyable bit of wrestling action here, and it was really fast. Like it, you could tell from the beginning that this match isn't going to be long because they were just working really fast with each other, and then of course it didn't go long. I think they used a roll-up finish to protect both guys' finishers because they probably knew at some point they would want this to be a pay-per-view main event again. And of course, that point I believe ended up being the Royal Rumble. Or no, that was Rock and Jericho, but they probably knew or assumed or hoped that they'd be able to get a pay-per-view main event with these guys. And the closest they came was what, Vengeance 2002 with that really good Angle, Rock, and Undertaker triple
I
threat?
believe that was the that would have been the last one, yeah.
Yeah.
So at the after that, Angle then cheap shots the Rock from behind, but he falls victim to the rock bottom. And then Jericho attacks Rock from behind. Angle pushes him away for a moment. He grabs the ankle. I can't help thinking here how fun an Angle Jericho alliance actually kind of would have been. But they never really went in that direction. They were both villains, but they were both doing their own thing, which is fine, but they both kind of had they had an interesting chemistry that I think could have could have done something. Angle's music plays for a bit, but then Jericho puts Rock in the walls again. Jericho teases leaving, but then puts it on again, and then two referees pull him off by pulling his hair, and probably do it too easily, honestly. I feel like they should have had a harder time getting wrestler Chris Jericho off of the Rock. But I guess it's nitpicking, but I guess it's pretty important how they present Jericho given where they're going with him, even if they didn't necessarily know that they were going to make him champion in a month. They certainly knew that, he was their number two or, heel.
Yeah. His position tier is one at heel 1A at the very least. Like
Exactly.
I, yeah, he was just like the Rock, and he was in there with the Rock, the number one baby face at that point as well. They weren't, it's an example of what we'd see a lot through Chris Jericho's title reign, actually, in that, yeah, Chris Jericho's a lead heel, but he's not being presented great.
Yeah, it's just the little things, and I don't know if they're his things or if he's not thinking things through, or if it's whoever puts it together, or I don't know what that where that's coming from, but that seemed to happen a lot, early on in his career, in his WWF career.
Should we just go ahead and blame Triple H? He wasn't around at the time. He was still learning to walk again, but I'm going to go ahead and blame Triple H
Well,
just for
Triple
the
H
hell of it.
at this point had learned how to, because he was almost back. He would be back. I guess it was. I guess it was about 6 weeks away. But so he was close. But
Damn you, Triple H.
yeah. So
Crushed by the internet.
now we have the Vince McMahon Kiss My Ass Club segment. A
Oh,
Kodak
boy.
moment, as Jim Ross says. Announces that he's selected William Regal, the former Alliance commissioner, to join the club. Regal comes out looking sheepish and perhaps a bit contrite. Vince demands that he hurry up. Regal says that he offers to fix the ring or the lights or fetch coffee, but Vince says, no, you must literally kiss my ass. Regal is astonished, has a wide-eyed look, and upon Vince's demand that he actually literally kiss his ass, he quietly says yes, because he wants to keep his job. So Vince takes off his jacket, milks this, just does milk this really great. Says Regal's position in front of him, so says that you may want to get on that side, and demands that he get on his knees. Points out the spot for Regal to go. And Regal's mannerisms just really make this just the slow realization of how much he's being degraded here, and how just how horrified he feels by it. Vince then starts to drop his pants to his underwear, and Regal looks even more horrified. But then Vince says, "Oh wait, it gets better than that." And then Vince drops it some more. And then Vince says the immortal lines of, "It's a nice looking ass, and look, I can even make my ass do tricks." And then
Amazing.
before the
Great.
yes. And he sort of, yeah, the camera doesn't really, the camera sees the side at the most. You don't really see the entire backside or anything, but the way they play it is, and it's genuinely very funny. He makes
I
Regal.
hate myself for enjoying
I
this so
do, but
much.
it's really good. It's really good. I mean,
Yeah.
Regal and Vince, it's because of their performances, I think, and just how ridiculous and absurd. It's just the right kind of absurd. Like it's hard
Yeah.
to explain, and you have to. I think you have to be a wrestling fan, and I think you have to know these characters and know this moment, or it helps anyway to for all those things to do. But I will give W. I'm not a lot of times not a big fan of WWE comedy, but I do, and I have a hard time defending this in a rational way, but it makes me laugh every time. So he makes Regal put the chapstick on. Regal slowly does so. And actually, I will say that Lawler, like the squealing and the, oh my God, he's gonna do this, and just the that kind of thing from Lawler actually also works very well here. By just being like incredibly, like you just giddy and like a kid about it.
Yeah. Well, Roth was cracking up the entire
He
time too.
was
I
too,
think
yeah.
Jim Roth, it's one of those times where WWF slash E's commentary gets maligned a lot because in the comedy segments you have big fake laughs from the commentators over them. There was nothing fake about Jim Ross and Jerry the King Lawler laughing at the Kiss My Ass Club.
Right. So finally we get the moment where Regal slowly moves his face and he kisses it, and Lawler screams he did it, and then says this is the greatest moment in the history of the WWF, and that's pretty good. So
Unbelievable. Really, if you are judging us for enjoying this segment and you know the characters of William Regal and Vince McMahon, which I'm guessing you do if you're listening to this podcast, find it online, watch it. It's really great commentary. I don't think another Kiss My Ass Club segment ever measured up to how good this one was.
It took everyone. It took the characters, and it took the commentary. It took the novelty of it, I think, for it all to work. But yes, and it's funny because this is sort of like Vince isn't really being a heel here. I mean, he is in a sense, but
No.
obviously the crowd is extremely pleased by this. So that's just another funny thing of Vince like straddling all these lines tonight of what he's doing. I mean, you're kind of, and there's a lot of, well, there aren't, and I don't know if a lot, but there's definitely been a few of these in WWE and WCW history where it's basically you're cramming through 6 weeks or more of storytelling kind of in one show just to kind of pass through things and get to the next point and get some distance from the previous stuff that you are acknowledging kind of sucked. And
Yeah, it's
so you then by nature you're kind of going through a lot of these different stages with Vince, where normally you'd progress through this stuff, 1 week at a time or so.
Do you think Vince is the character that progresses the most throughout the show? I mean, I know he's seen the most, so he's given the most opportunities, but do you think that he's the character that has to change the most for the future of WWF in a way to work?
I don't know. I guess so. I mean, I guess I can't really think. I don't, you know, Angle changes a bit. Jericho doesn't really change. Austin doesn't really change. He doesn't really do much, honestly. He's not there throughout much of the show. So I guess, yeah, I would say Vince. I would say Vince would be that choice.
And we have a question about Austin's face turn from the Twitter that we'll get to. But I would say Vince McMahon had to be that person because he was, you know, the Alliance before The Rock came back at SummerSlam that year. He was the baby face of the Alliance. Like it was a little bit of. There was a little bit of Chris Jericho being a babyface, a little bit of Undertaker and Kane, but they're weak as number one babyfaces, so you really needed Vince McMahon to be strong, and I think fans did rally behind him a fair amount, and he got to be the babyface that he needed to be. But then, of course, throughout this show, you know, he came out as the magnanimous owner and got the big pop and got to do the celebration at the beginning. And you see him go through certain phases as the show ends. And I think Vince's arc through this episode of Raw might be one of the strongest and definitely the most monumental one-show character arcs that WWF has ever done.
I would say it's certainly the most involved, if nothing else. So,
yeah.
So we do get a replay, which is hurt a little bit by Lawler making a fart noise, and you definitely get JR laughing a lot during this part of it as well. They do replay it quite a bit, and they do sort of even more emphasize the juvenile nature of it during the replays. But what are you going to do? It's a man kissing another man's ass, so I guess you're going to have that.
The replays heard it. Don't watch the replays, yeah. Guys. Especially the fart noise. Right. That is unnecessary.
That is, yeah. That's just gross, Dre Lawler. So, Regal's freaking out backstage. He yells at Taz, who quite wittily calls him a kiss ass.
Nice work, Taz.
Regal decides to punch him out. Now we have Kane and Chris Jericho. Jericho attacks Kane during Kane's pyro, which I can't remember anyone ever doing before. As he's, you know, as he's putting his hands down, the flames are coming from the turnbuckles, or the posts, I guess.
Takes a brave man to mess with that fire.
That's true.
Yeah.
Kane hits a backdrop. Jericho lands on his chin. Then Jericho slips out of a power slam onto the apron, drops Kane's back onto the ropes. A horn goes off randomly in the arena. Then later, Jericho gets a couple of swinging neck breakers and a lion salt, but Kane catches him by the throat. Teddy Long gets in the way, so Jericho is able to low blow Kane. Jericho, for some reason, sneaks in to get a chair, but Kane kicks it away. Long, instead of tossing the chair out, just leaves it in the ring. Even Jerry Lawler comments on it. Kane gets a big power slam, goes to the top, but Jericho swings the chair as he's coming off for a disqualification, which I just kind of thought, like, hey, there couldn't you guys think of a better way to get the chair in here rather than Jericho grabbing it randomly when he had an advantage and no reason to need to bring it in. He then nails Kane with the chair twice, tries the walls of Jericho, is unable to sort of turn him over and lock it. He tries, drops it twice, so eventually just sort of grabs the legs and locks it in. Teddy Long sort of tries to break it up. And Jericho sort of has trouble locking it again, so he sort of ends up basically just giving up, which really was not the best night for Jericho. There was sort of a lot of, like, mishaps and little things that went wrong for him tonight, whether it was just screw-ups or just not well thought out things.
Yeah, this was not a banner night to be Chris Jericho, but I'd say he did pretty well.
I mean, they booked him to lay out everybody, and I mean, I get that, like, that was fine, but it was just, like, you know, like little stuff just didn't just having a hard time grabbing Kane's legs and putting him in the Walls of Jericho. Just, you know, not the best night. We all have our bad nights.
It's true. We do. And sadly, or thankfully, most of my bad nights do not begin on the night when I'm kind of starting the biggest push that I'll probably get in my career.
There you go.
As Jericho was.
Right. So, Angle and Edge have a confrontation backstage. Angle demands a thank you for Edge for keeping his job. Edge points out that he was able to unify the U.S. and Intercontinental titles, and that kept his job. Then he makes a suggestion further than anyone else has made before that he believes that that Angle may have been playing both sides and might have, if things had been different, might have helped the Alliance get the winning pinfall and kept his job in that way. So, if he had seen the opportunity to go the other way. So, there we go. By the way.
Yeah, again, baby faces letting us know, don't like Kurt Angle.
Yeah, do not like Kurt Angle. We are still awaiting Stone Cold Steve Austin, by the way. Just so you know.
Yeah, so we're...
He might be a little late.
For a guy that now on his podcast discusses how he was always the first one to get there and the last one to leave, he showed up to a lot of buildings suspiciously late, like very far after the start of shows.
Yeah. That's a little weird, Stone Cold. Just saying.
Yeah. Why was the WWF at this time so obsessed with parking lot arrivals?
Well, it's dramatic, you know?
Like, there's a car driving up. Who can it be? Oh, my goodness. It's the same guy that drove up in a car last week. Like, you'd think that now I would love for them to do one where John Cena just rolls up in his tour bus and is like, sorry, I was asleep back there for like 3 hours. When's Raw?
I do. Yeah. We are sort of not, we are no longer in the era of arrival by vehicle, I guess, you know. I mean, people do still show up late sometimes at shows, right? I mean, not everyone's on time. Or is pretty much everyone on time now?
I think a couple weeks ago we had John Cena, or it was the week before the Rumble or something. John Cena showed up to Raw like 2 hours and 59 minutes into the show.
Yeah.
And ran straight in shorts from the freezing cold parking lot into the arena to fight Randy Orton. Like... the dude didn't even stop to be like, it was chilly. Dang. No, in his shorts, straight parking lot to arena, fought Randy Orton back around to the outside and then walked inside. Like, John Cena had the shortest work day ever.
Didn't need a time to clock in.
No, I don't know if he got paid for that day. I should ask him.
Yeah, that's a good question. If you ever, you know, if you ever run into him, that's the first thing you should ask.
I'm going to write down the date just to make sure I do if I ever run into him.
All right, that's very smart. So now we have William Regal against Taz. Regal is in his shirt and pants. We replay the kiss, of course. Taz is in a tracksuit. Regal attacks him, and the two of them trade blows for about a minute. Ross, during this time, mentions that Taz was retained as to be the SmackDown commentator, so he's able to maintain his position in the company. Lucky for him. Taz tries a Taz mission, but Regal breaks out of it. Regal then gets a knee to the head and locks in the STF. It doesn't take long, and Regal gets the STF. And there's interesting visual because of all of Taz's pyro, the smoke filled the ring. And so, they're enveloped in this smoke as Regal is getting the submission. And he won't let go for a while until the refs finally ask him nicely, I guess, and he does. We have a lot of the heels who will not let go of submissions tonight.
Yeah, that's a big thing on this show. I have two things from the last segment.
Sure.
One, doesn't Sean Stasiak now wish he would have said yes to commentating for Jacked? I think Sean Stasiak is beating himself up about missing the opportunity to be retained as the Jacked color commentator.
Yeah.
Two, Regal, the whole like Regal thing, do you think it's possible that they actually, I know this will sound funny now, do you think the actual motivation for putting him in the Kiss My Ass Club, aside from glorifying that fantastic ass of Vince McMahon's was to make Regal into a more serious competitor, because this, he looked absolutely vicious here. And I thought, wow, if they would have done this for like 3 months, had Regal beating guys this way or close to this way and looking this aggressive in the ring, and then put him in a main event program with whoever your lead babyface is at that point, that would have been pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would have been good. I kind of took this more as getting his heat back kind of thing. Like, okay, we humiliated him, but we want to give his heat back quickly. And Taz, you know, was on his – he was becoming the SmackDown commentator. His wrestling career wasn't lasting that much longer anyway. I think he was done by the middle of 02. So I guess that was kind of the thing. It did seem like maybe like they didn't need to do it this week, but maybe they just really wanted. I mean, I guess I do see your point. Like, I do think it was sort of, it was meant to sort of be something that would inspire him to have more heat. I mean, you know, partially because of, you know, being the guy to kiss, and also I guess if it unveiled that vicious side of him. But they. He may have kind of kept that, but he certainly wasn't ever really pushed strongly, you know, on it. I mean, he certainly did. He had a good career, but he never, you know, reached kind of that top level.
Yeah.
I mean, he was he never reached kind of the level that people always sort of hoped that he would be able to reach. And yeah, I guess there was a mix of reasons for that, but.
Yeah. Taz had an unusual amount of an unusually large amount of pyro for a color commentator.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess they knew that he wasn't going to be having it very much longer, so they just had to get rid of it, I guess. So they went overboard. Very smoky ring.
Well, it's like how Batista got his pyro blast. Isn't the old tale about it that may or may not be true? They just had the Raw opening pyro geared up, and it was cut at the last minute. So they're trying to figure out something for Batista, and they're just like, we're going to shoot this off behind you. Have fun. And he machine gunned.
Huh. I've never heard that story.
Yeah. I'm going with it as absolutely true. That's I don't know if it is. It could just be an old wives' tale, but I'm going to say that it's the truest story in wrestling history.
Why not?
Yeah. Just source it to a website other than mine if you're going to report on it.
WrestleSpective.com.
Yeah, there it is.
There you go. True report. That seems fair.
I should have used my fake
alias. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's tough. Next time, use your alias. Because no one's heard you on my show and knows what your voice sounds like before, you know?
No, and there aren't other podcasts where people could hear my voice either, so no one will know.
Exactly.
Maybe we should just use some sort of voice, like I could be like, you know, on the news, the voice that they give the guys that they only shoot in silhouette, like when they want to remain anonymous.
Sure.
I could do the whole podcast like this.
There you go. Just do that voice. That's good.
Would we have to do an Undertaker match at that point?
We might, you know.
He rested in peace. He rested very much in peace.
It was very peaceful.
No Undertaker on this show, was he? Right?
Yeah. He comes back next week, though.
Yeah. Well, plus side, we did not have to hear Limp Bizkit's Rollin'.
We didn't have to, or we didn't get to?
I'm going to go with have to. And oh my gosh, I don't know if you saw this on Survivor Series. And I'm sorry to whoever you're going to podcast that match with, because I'm going to steal an awesome point here. Mm-hmm. The whitest person in the world doing the Rollin' dance when Undertaker came out, just full on close up of him, doing it in the dorkiest way possible. I was so happy to have seen him.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a magical moment.
Yeah.
So Kurt Angle is sad once again about losing to The Rock and not being shown any appreciation for his efforts. So Vince comes out, says he'll show you his appreciation. He says, how would you like to be the World Wrestling Federation champion? And Kurt says, he says, of course. And so Vince invites him to the ring for the final segment. Angle and Vince walk out to Angle's music. Vince holding the title. Announcers wonder how Vince can do this. And left unmentioned, but I guess is sort of important, is the fact that, you know, Vince had this long feud with Stone Cold, and the one thing he sort of refused to do was award someone else the belt.
Yeah, that's never been Vince McMahon's MO. He will set up a match where it's sure that Steve Austin will lose the title, but he the whole time wouldn't just say, give me that here to The Rock or to anyone else. So it is really interesting that at this point he'd be like, yeah, just going to take the title from him and give it to Kurt Angle. Maybe it was Vince McMahon just escalating his frustration or his anger escalating to the point that he needed to do that, or maybe the Vince McMahon character felt Steve Austin crossed a line when he joined the Alliance that now he cannot uncross, so he has to do something bad to Austin.
Yes. It would have been nice maybe for that to be a little bit, have been communicated a little more, some of that, but, you know, yeah. I guess you can't do everything, but.
And did they want people to sympathize with McMahon's position?
There would have been that's a decent point too. So Vince says this is typical Stone Cold. Don't show up the night after you're defeated, which of course is funny in retrospect, given Stone Cold walking out in the company in the next summer. He says the WWF needs a champion with dignity, class, and credibility. He said he wanted Austin to be there so he could strip the title, but he's going to go ahead and do it anyway. And then as soon as he says the words, as the sole owner, Ric Flair's music hits. He's out in a very dapper suit. It's a first time in WWF in 8 years. Huge reaction, as you might expect. Lawler calls it a cheap pop. Jim Ross says, is this a mirage? Is Ric Flair really here? Vince says, oh, he almost forgot that this is Ric Flair's hometown, but you're almost forgotten. And then Flair, after they trade some words, Flair says, I bet on a winner last night. And then Flair sort of goes back and says that this is no way for Angle to win the title. And you get a nice, you see the close-up of Vince and Kurt's right there, and off the mic he says, I don't care, that he's happy to take the title this way, which is just a funny, whether it was an ad lib or whatever, it was very, very good by Kurt. Vince says...
Kurt was good at comedy during this time.
Right, yes.
So many tiny hats tell you that.
Exactly. Vince says he's not interested in Flair's opinion, but Flair says, well, sort of tries to explain that Shane and Stephanie sold their stock to a consortium, and then he says, the consortium, and he pauses to strut and come off the ropes and says, the consortium was me, we're partners. And Vince sort of does this weird, like, grab his ear thing reaction that indicates that he is not happy about what he's heard. But he sort of grabs his ear like he has an earache, sort of, it's sort of odd. And then Stone Cold comes out with the really bad version of his theme song, which I've always hated. I think it might be by Disturbed, but I don't know. Or maybe it's...
I don't think that was the Disturbed one.
Oh, yeah, that was after that. Yeah, I don't know who that was by, but I think that was even the worst. I'm not... Well, actually, I think the Disturbed one was worse than this one, but...
It's the really fast version of his theme song. Either way, it's the one... it's not the ba-bum-ba-bum-bum-bum. It's a da-da-da-da-da-da. Like, it just sounds weird seeing him walk to it because his walk was so... like the rhythm of his music and the rhythm that he walked to the ring were so in sync, and you could really define Austin by that rhythm. Like something about that rhythm really fit him. And when they tried to make it faster, and you can say it was supposed to represent Austin's paranoia as a heel, but I just don't think it works.
Yeah. Well, he went back to the regular music soon enough anyway. So Angle tries to talk, but Austin beats him up right away. Vince tries to stop it, but Austin tackles him down. Flair grabs a hold of the belt and watches Austin toss out Vince. We get a Flair and Austin stare down for a little bit. Then Austin grabs the belt from Flair's shoulder. Flair has a big smile. Austin drinks and does his usual celebration. He tosses a beer to Flair and they toast. Vince and Angle are sat on the apron in the meantime. Vince, and then we have the JR's line of Vince McMahon and Ric Flair are business partners. Oh my God. And that's the close of the show.
Yeah, it definitely, you know, it introduced Flair nicely. I think this was the beginning. You've talked about this in past podcasts, how it's almost like the WWE spent now through, or like 2001 through like probably 2006 in a way, trying to recreate WCW, trying to recreate the magic that there was about them and just the magic of that feud in general of WWE and WCW. And you kind of see that this is the first step towards the first time they'll do that with a Ric Flair owning half and McMahon owning half and then eventually creating the brand split. And it's just interesting to see that step one was, we're gonna introduce Flair because he's a figure that's so so closely defined as a WCW guy.
Right, yeah, very much an actual contrast to Vince, where I don't think the Alliance really ever had a clear identity.
Nope.
Where Flair instantly gave you know, his side eventually, and not that they necessarily did a whole lot to take advantage of that. I'm actually not really sure the Vince Flair story was much better than the Invasion, although this was obviously a great start. But at least Flair gave you that contrast, gave you kind of something, you know?
Yeah, the Vince Flair story I don't think was better than the Invasion, but I believe that solely because of the blow off to the Vince Flair story. Like, that's wasn't that on that same Raw that Austin walked out on?
Yeah, it was.
That would be an interesting episode of Raw to go back and watch.
That's true.
But yeah, that they blew off that rivalry so quick, and it's kind of the same thing as the Invasion, where it wasn't booked perfectly from beginning to end, but you could kind of see where the end was supposed to be, but they just skipped a lot of things to get there. And I think the Invasion was kind of the same, but with the way they did the Invasion, they just filled WCW, ECW with so many really definable WWF guys, with Steve Austin, with Christian, like, and even Diamond Dallas Page, easily probably the biggest star that they got to jump ship. They gave him that weird stalker angle instead of having him be Diamond Dallas Page. It was all so strange that this new beginning at least felt like, okay, we're probably going to get a rehash of the Invasion story in one way or another, but hopefully this one will be a little bit better.
Yeah. All right. Well, anything else to say about the show before we hit the Twitter questions?
I think it's Twitter question time.
All right. Well, past guest Jeff Martin at Heat Comic wants to know, what are your thoughts on WWE's ongoing fixation with legal/corporate storylines in a wrestling show?
I think it's bad. I wrote about this actually. I've written about this extensively this past year or this past few months with the Authority thing happening on Raw and with Dixie Carter's prominence on TNA Impact. I think wrestling is at a point where it needs to ditch all of the corporate and all of the Authority stuff, and you know, have your Jack Tunney like figure that makes the tough decisions when they need to be made. But for the most part, have a championship committee, have guys that go on roles, get title shots, really get back to more basic storytelling. And I don't mean basic as bad or simplistic. You can tell unique and intricate stories within those stories, but let those stories dominate, because wrestling promos now, or I sound like an old guy when I started watching wrestling as this stuff was happening, but promos are more about this business and how people love this business and how important business is, when it's like, make it more about kicking ass. You're going to be okay.
And power struggles within the organization, and well, this happened, so I'm going to make this match for tonight, or you did this, so I'm going to this. This has this consequence. It just feels like, the Steph and Triple H Authority stuff has been pretty good in the last few weeks, but
yeah,
I do think, considering the amount of Authority figure characters that we've had over the past 15 years since, Vince, Austin really took off, and, you know, EC or NWO Bischoff before then, so more than 15 years, I feel like the percentage of that stuff that has landed has been relatively small, and the percentage of stuff that just seems like pointless time wasting, your Vicky Guerrero and your Oh, what's that guy's name? Brad Maddox.
Brad Maddox.
Those guys, who, and they're fine performers, but just sort of like, or fighting with Kane about who gets to book this match or things like that. It feels like that stuff just sort of makes the shows really plod and go on and just no, not fun.
Yeah, and that I think that's the thing is these struggles were fun at one point. Like they were legitimately fun to sit down and watch, and they aren't anymore. So they should be gone. Like that's maybe it's being a little too simplistic, but I just don't think that it's a I don't think it's viable. And I would argue just like I would argue that when wrestling, if wrestling ever does have that boom again or that place where it becomes mainstream popular, it's going to be without these things. Like it's going to be without the authority figure stuff.
It'll take a new template because we've been stuck in this template for a long time, and I feel like that's, I mean, it's not necessarily the thing that's keeping wrestling from being bigger, but it's definitely something that I mean, I think it's going to have to come out of that framework for, I agree with you. I think that's going to be one of the things that sort of needs to like trigger like a, and at least an expansion in their audience, in their, regular TV audience. All right, we have Flying Brian with a PH, PHLYIN Brian with a Y. Last time I screwed that up, so I figured it out this time. Flying Brian, is it realistic to think that WWE would have ever considered delaying the WCW invasion to coincide with Flair's return? I mean, yeah, I think that that actually probably would have been a good idea. But I know that they were really, I mean, the reason they proceeded with the WCW invasion when they did was because they were a little bit desperate because their ratings had started to go down. And I mean, that's kind of my understanding of the reason that they kind of went with that. But I think if you had, I think the ideal thing if they could have done, and if they weren't able to get the talent until later, is to sort of have like they had a Saturday night block they ended up having as like WWF XS that, if you had been able to make that like late night Saturday show your WCW show, let your expectations for ratings be kind of small. Let it mostly be the leftover talent that you brought over with a few WWF guys to kind of spice it up, but not trying to water it down too much. But sort of let that kind of be its own thing for a while. Maybe you could do like a special like one time, the idea of it being like a one time WCW versus WWF pay-per-view to kind of see who's the best, just to kind of get that like instant, like one time big boost, but mostly keep them separate until you're kind of able to bring some of those big WCW stars in over the next year, and then try to do your big feud between the two groups. And that gives you a lot more time to plan it, and that gives you, to kind of and see what you have, whether your WCW is viable, that, what you kind of need to do, but have it sort of off on this third show where there's less pressure to have it be, needing to be tremendously successful, I mean, that would, but then again, the pressures they had may have made that completely unrealistic.
Yeah, and I think it really does come down to being a slave to ratings, and their hands were tied also by okay, they invested a ton in the two-man power trip, and by all accounts, that was supposed to be the big story for the whole year was the two-man power trip of Triple H and Steve Austin, and Triple H got hurt and won't be back until January on the early side of his recovery. Well, we have to do something. We have to tell a story here that they can't just randomly have things on TV. So, okay, well, this alliance thing that, this will do. We'll go with WWF or we'll go with WCW and ECW now instead of wait till we can get Flair. But I don't know if Flair himself would have been the enough of a change given the other way that they booked WCW and given the fact that the biggest obstacle in the alliance story was Vince McMahon never really letting WCW and ECW get any heat.
Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of things which I know we've discussed and has been discussed on many different programs, so we don't need to go through every single thing, but yeah, I definitely agree. Next, Jack Can't Cook asks, would the inexplicable Austin face turn have been more difficult to pull off if the what chant didn't exist?
No, I don't think so. The inexplicable Austin face turn to me had everything to do with the fact that on this show, they managed to make Vince McMahon and Kurt Angle into really hated heels.
And people didn't want to boo Austin. The fans.
Yeah. And people wanted to cheer Austin from WrestleMania 17 on.
Yeah.
No one really wanted to boo him. So why, now that he was doing good things and especially being in there with Ric Flair as well. I mean, there were like three layers of protection on Steve Austin, making sure that he was going to get cheered when he came out for that final segment.
I do think while the Austin Alliance character was great in a lot of ways, I do think that like Austin sort of lost his aura after this point. You know, I don't think he ever quite reestablished it. I mean, he obviously was popular. People liked him. He was still over and you know, next to The Rock was their biggest star, but it wasn't ever quite the same.
Yeah, it didn't, especially going into WrestleMania 18. It was weird watching this, and Austin, he's still presented as this huge star, and he, you know, he is celebrating with Ric Flair and the title at the end of the night, and you're like, oh, things are going to be pretty okay for Stone Cold, and then 4 months later, WrestleMania 18, he's in a mid-card match against Scott Hall that never really clicks, and you're like, things weren't really okay for old Stone Cold, were they?
Yeah. Eric Darcy at I Am Darcy wants to know, what are your thoughts on all of the face and heel turns on the show? I would say there actually aren't that many. I mean, there's a couple. I mean, I guess Austin and Angle are the big ones where they actually do turn. I think everyone else is sort of just, well, I,
and McMahon.
Vince turns. Yes, that's true. Everyone else is fairly cementing. Now, I believe it's the week after this that The Undertaker turns. And that was kind of the big one for me. It's like, oh, you know, because he hadn't, I mean, I guess he'd actually had been a heel a couple years earlier, but I felt like that turn kind of came out of nowhere. And it wasn't necessarily my favorite period of The Undertaker, but I will say that he did, that heel run allowed him to kind of convey a lot of different aspects of his character that he had never really been able to convey before. He was able to be more dynamic as a heel. He could be cowardly. He could be, he could kind of do all these things that he had sort of been limited by when he was the dead man, whether he was a face or a heel in that instance.
Yeah, I would say Undertaker's heel turn. It helped him, just like I think the biker period itself helped him find himself for his final run. I think that the period of time he spent as a heel between a 2000 or from like end of 2001 to end of 2002-ish was really valuable. As far as all the turns on the show, like you said, more of them were to confirm characters. And the thing is, because WWF itself was pushed as the lead babyface, the lead entity, against another entity, and they lost so much of what was the Alliance. I mean, those guys, a lot of them weren't even on the show because they lost so much of the Alliance. They, I feel like, had to go and turn a lot of guys quickly just to be able to tell the stories that they needed to tell. That they had to reestablish a lead heel. They had to reestablish lead characters in the Alliance, outside of the Alliance story now. So I think it's just the nature of doing the broad reset that they did, that they had to reestablish so much.
Yeah, definitely. Brad W at Brad 21126 asks, why do you think Rob Van Dam's push seemed to fizzle post invasion? Should he have been rushed into the No Mercy 2001 main? I think he was fine in that main event. I mean, he was at the right spot there. I assume it fizzled post invasion because, well, maybe he got a little bit lost in the shuffle with the NWO coming in and kind of them fo and Triple H coming back and them focusing on the other top stars, or past stars, or however you want to put it. And I guess maybe kind of the other problems that we've alluded to with our Rob Van Dam in the past.
Yeah, I think that it's a little bit of just Rob Van Dam being Rob Van Dam and a little bit of WWF. They always had this reluctance or seemed to be reluctant to get behind Rob Van Dam. And maybe it's that, okay, well, people love his moveset and he's flashy, but not always the best wrestler. Maybe it's just that they didn't think that that he deserved to be where he was and was on the caliber with the WWF guys like Undertaker, like Steve Austin and all that. I can't exactly say why it fizzled, but I don't remember a ton of times going, "Oh, Rob Van Dam should always be main eventing." I don't think I think Rob Van Dam is sometimes overvalued as a performer considering what he was capable of.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Tom Holzerman at T Holzerman asks, how different do you think Invasion would have been if Hogan, Outsider, Sting, and everyone were on board from the jump? Now, I this is maybe a bigger question than we want to answer, but I do think I kind of think it's interesting to kind of consider that, like. I think it would have obviously been better and more, more successful, but I do think there's a very good chance it could have burned out, maybe not quite as quickly. They could have maybe gotten a year out of it instead of 6 months. But I do feel like if their creative isn't a whole lot better, it's not necessary, I feel like they're going to kind of burn out of everything pretty fast and run into some of the same problems that they ran into here and that, frankly, WCW ran into in 99 and 2000 with a lot of that same talent.
Yeah, I don't know that the talent would have helped things. For one, okay, Hogan and the Outsiders come in as the NWO, which they would do, what, 3 months later? But let's say they come in as the NWO now with this show. What side are they on? Do they are they their own contingent the way the NWO was presented in WCW? Are they trying to take down the WWF as a part of WCW, but still the faction, the NWO? And then you get kind of what they ran into in 2002 of, man, Hogan was back in WWF. No one wanted to see him in white and black. That's not what fans were really clamoring for. And you even see it. I watched just randomly on the network the other day. I turned on the beginning of the No Way Out 2002 pay-per-view that has the NWO coming out first thing for their first appearance. Hogan got a huge ovation as he took the mic. People didn't want to boo him. So why would you try and force that in 2001? And really, same thing with Hall and Nash when there are other stories you could tell with Sting and guys like that. I think it if you bulk up, put Sting and Goldberg on the Invasion side, bulk them up with names and say that the creative say that maybe the plan for WrestleMania 18 then becomes Goldberg versus Steve Austin. That's what WWE decides they want to build to. All right, the creative around it is going to be better. They're going to tell a little bit of a better story because they're going to have Goldberg barrel through people and build up to a match with Steve Austin. But you bet, you can pretty much bet on Steve Austin beating Goldberg at WrestleMania that year, and a lot of that mystique being gone. That feud that you spent all that time building up to is over. Now what do you do? And I just don't think that the WWF creatively was in the right place to do this. And I don't know. I don't know that the war itself, if everything were optimal, I were in like optimal shape and condition and all of that, I don't know that the invasion itself ever could have lived up to the invasion that wrestling fans imagined. And I think that the idea of it is this massive failure exists because everyone that was a fan at that time has this image in their head of what would have been perfect, these dream matches, these dream moments, you know, Sting dropping out of the sky to Scorpion Death Drop the Undertaker and all that. I don't know that even if all of those things would have happened, that it would have worked the way that people think it would.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would have been better, but I do, but yeah, I agree with the expectations being pretty much impossible to realize. And I will say that WWE did give us most of that stuff eventually, not all at one time, but you know, like we talked to, like you mentioned, referred to, you know, throughout 2002 and 3 and 4 and 5, you know, had, you know, you had your Goldberg run, you had your NWO in your Hogan revival, you had Flair, you had your, you know, longtime WCW mid-carders, Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero winning world titles, you know, all that stuff. So you kind of had all this, all the promise that, you know, WCW seemed to have, you know, whether it was an invasion or even in its own kind of stuff, WWE, most of it at least tried to emulate somewhat, some of it good, some of it not, some of it sort of a mixed bag, but eventually they did give us most of those moments. No Sting, I guess, but other than that, you know, they gave us pretty much, you know, a version of pretty much everything that we could have thought of.
Yeah. And so on that note, I don't think it was a massive failure. I don't think it was a huge success either. I think creatively, they just needed to get away from it, which is what this show was about. This show was as much about running from the past 4 months as anything else. Running from WCW and ECW, I mean, you know, I don't know. They may have said ECW twice on the show total. WCW, it was only mentioned in saying, hey guys, it's not the WCW title anymore, it's the world title. We're calling it the world title. It's the world title now. So I think they were really trying to get away from that story. And I don't know, you know, like you said, without the creative being brilliant on that and on the invasion, it wouldn't have been better.
Yeah. All right, one last question. From Voices of Wrestling, at Voices Wrestling, how much do you think the flip-flopping of Kurt Angle hurt his momentum in becoming a big star draw? Or did it? What are your thoughts?
I don't know. I don't know that it hurt his momentum. It definitely showed his flexibility. I think that more than the flip-flopping, the comedy surrounding Kurt Angle hurt his momentum. There were things that Kurt Angle did that you wouldn't see Steve Austin doing, and you probably wouldn't see The Rock doing. And there were just certain silly moments that were really cool, like the milk spraying. Okay, it's clever, it's funny, you can laugh at it, but it's not a serious babyface thing.
Yeah.
And Kurt oftentimes lacked the ability, the seriousness that you would want a guy who might be in his position to have. So I don't know that the flip-flopping of Kurt Angle hurt him as much as that. And really, Kurt Angle coming along at, he was both helped and hurt by coming along during the time when both Austin and Rock were on top and were the biggest stars in the world, because they needed opponents. So wherever they were, Kurt Angle was going to be on the opposite side because he was a great opponent for either guy. And I believe that Kurt Angle was helped by that, and that he was elevated by standing across the ring so often from Steve Austin and The Rock and those guys. But he at the same time was also hurt by that because, well, Kurt Angle now has, or he, you could say he was hurt by that because, well, now he's got to be a heel because Steve Austin's a babyface. Oh, wait, no. Now he's got to be a babyface. Steve Austin turned heel. He needs that opponent. Kurt, get in there. So I would say, being the utility player that he was, if anything hurt him, it might have been that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I do think when you have characters that it's hard to sort of count on, like where they're going to be and what they're going to do. Like when it starts to be happen so often, the turning, where I do think it kind of, I don't know, it makes it harder to support them a little bit because you feel like you can't rely on them. I don't know. I do feel like there is something to that. And I feel like it's hurt guys like maybe your Big Shows and your Lex Lugers, you know, guys like that who have, you know, known for, you know, turning, all the time, but I can't really see, I can't really point to like a specific instance where like this happened with Kurt and it prevented this and this didn't happen. Like, I feel like Kurt basically had the career he should have had, you know? So I honestly, the answer is I'm not sure.
And that's a perfectly fine answer. Yeah, I don't know what else Kurt Angle does. Like, I don't know what more Kurt Angle could have done. I mean, maybe he's seen as a bigger star today if WWF wouldn't have feared for his life in 2006 and released him, but they did, and now he's in TNA, and they are TNA. So,
Everyone seems to like
yeah,
them.
that's pretty much how I describe TNA these days, by the way.
They are
So they're
TNA.
TNA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They exist. They are a thing.
Yeah.
I believe. As
It's
far as I know.
I hear there's wrestling on Thursdays. I can't confirm or deny this,
Yeah.
but
All right, sir. Well, you want to
yeah.
let our people know about what you do at prowrestling.net?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm right now I'm doing something I do every year. In the 5 or 6 weeks leading up to WrestleMania every year, I write a blog series. I kind of take a wrestler or a topic. 2 years ago, I watched all of the Undertaker's streak matches and wrote extensively about his career. Last year, I wrote about all of the guys who won the Royal Rumble for the WrestleMania title shot. So from 1993 to 2012. And this year I'm actually writing about John Cena and his 10 WrestleMania matches and how just kind of the microcosm of his career that each match is and how he evolves, how he changes, and with the ultimate goal kind of being to figure out does John Cena deserve the way that fans treat him? What are the most remarkable things about John Cena's career, and what really you can learn a lot about a wrestler through watching him this way. So I'm in the middle of that blog series right now, and you can find that on prowrestling.net. New ones out every Monday up until the Monday before WrestleMania, which will be the last one. And then I'm always on our podcasts and all that stuff talking about wrestling and other things. So yeah, check it out. I also write about Raw on Tuesday mornings and Impact on Friday mornings usually. So there is plenty of me on prowrestling.net. And for any of it, you can follow me on Twitter at It's Will Time and find those things, yo.
Cool. Well, thanks again for being on the program. Of course, everyone, thanks for listening. If you get a chance, be great if you could submit some feedback to us on iTunes or on Stitcher. You can find me on Twitter at WrestleSpective, for non-wrestling things, also at Jason Mann Ohioan. Appreciate everyone listening, checking us out, giving us feedback, whatever works. So continue please to do so, and thanks again, and come back and see us another time.
Thanks for listening.